Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about the significant geopolitical shift that's occurred in this region because of the war that started on October 7th. Under the former U.S. President Donald Trump, our prime minister, who was essentially a friend of Trump, they aligned their approaches because the idea was, under Trump, to improve the relationship between Israel and the other Arab nations. And in a sense, they sidelined the whole issue of the Palestinians. They signed accords, the so-called Abraham Accords, with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. And all this apparently was done with the tacit approval of Saudi Arabia. So, which in a sense was really something new, because in the past, Saudi Arabia would have nothing to do with any kind of normalization with Israel until there'd be the establishment of a Palestinian state. So there have been other talks during the Biden administration. So there's a tentative agreement for a defense alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States, and perhaps some normalization with Israel. Now, since the Hamas attack on October 7th, the Biden administration has seized an opportunity to bring back the discussions on the two-state solution. The issue of Palestinian state has been brought back into focus by the American administration. Throughout this conflict, the U.S. President Biden has voiced support for a unified governing system for a Palestinian state. And that's what he's been talking about. And the American administration began conditioning normalization with Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries on Israel's willingness to transfer control of Gaza to some revitalized Palestinian authority after Hamas is defeated, because the American administration, as I understand it, is pushing for the establishment of a Palestinian state. According to the Washington Post, on February 15, 2024, that's about 2 weeks ago, the United States and a select group of Middle Eastern nations are working on a detailed plan for Middle East peace, including a schedule for establishing a Palestinian state. In other words, under the Biden administration, the United States is pushing for the establishment of a Palestinian state. Now, Israel has no choice. Israel must resist the idea of recognizing a Palestinian state, and Israel must find a way to push back against the American pressure on this matter. The Israeli government made a declaratory resolution which opposes the unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state. It was voted upon the Knesset, and 99 out of 120 members of the Knesset voted not to recognize a Palestinian state. So this action essentially demonstrated Israel's very broad public consensus against being forced into establishing a Palestinian state without direct negotiations with the Palestinians, and Israel, essentially Israel's Knesset, rejected foreign interference in resolving this conflict. The idea, the very idea of unilaterally recognizing the establishment of a Palestinian state suggests that even the worst attack against Jews since the Holocaust that occurred in October hasn't sufficiently changed the U.S. Democratic administration's attitude to creation of a Palestinian state. The United States, under this administration at least, remains stuck to the belief of two states for two people. Granting recognition to a Palestinian state after what happened in October of last year would be a reward for Palestinian terrorism, and such an action would embolden Palestinians to persist in their terrorism against Israel. What is their ultimate objective? The creation of a single Arab state from the river to the sea. In other words, they still want to destroy the state of Israel. Everything they've done since the October, the Oslo Accords more than 30 years ago has been with the aim of destroying the state of Israel. So, interesting. A poll was conducted by a Palestinian group, and 82% of Palestinian residents support the attack on Israel on October 7th. Now, the Palestinian Authority, which Israel essentially established, brought back Yasser Arafat from North Africa 30 years ago, the Palestinian Authority's stance toward Israel pretty much is the same that of Hamas in Gaza. Through its education, its culture, and its official media, the Palestinian Authority consistently foments hostility toward Israel and the Jewish people. Nothing has changed. Moreover, it financially incentivizes terrorism against Jews by providing allowances to the families of terrorists. So these actions by the Palestinian Authority not only perpetuate animosity toward Israel, but they continue to undermine the legitimacy of the Jewish state. These are the facts on the ground. There are no two ways about it. Now, on top of all this is also the fact that the Palestinian Authority is unable to effectively govern anything. This deficiency in governance and the lack of any kind of administrative capability poses a real security threat to Israel. In other words, if you allow the Palestinian Authority to take over Gaza after this war is over, but it would still be a security threat to Israel because the Palestinian Authority is incapable of governing. So what happens is, or what happens would be, without the presence of Israeli security forces in Gaza and Judea and Samaria, it's possible that the Palestinian Authority would collapse, because its leadership has no legitimacy, and what would happen be with a Hamas takeover. Recognizing the Palestinian Authority as a Palestinian state would result in instability and the rise of some kind of Islamic regime that would be devoted to the destruction of the state of Israel. Now, even the U.S. administration now, under Biden, acknowledges the necessity of reform within the Palestinian Authority for it to function as a responsible state. In other words, right now the Americans are pushing for a renewed Palestinian Authority to take over the area, but they're incapable of governing. From a topographical perspective, a Palestinian state controlling the mountain range of the land of Israel would have control over Israel's densely populated coastal plain, which includes in Israel critical infrastructure like our airport, seaport, government offices. Everything in Israel would be under the mountains of the Palestinian Authority. It would be vulnerable to continuous terror attacks from the Palestinian state or whoever takes over from the Palestinian state. The bottom line is, under the present situation, under the present reality, Israel must control the entire territory from the Jordan Sea, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. Otherwise, the country would be susceptible to terror raids and invasions, and we can't allow that. Therefore, the bottom line is that Israel must resist international pressure, particularly from the United States, pressure to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state. Israel must be opposed to that. It should emphasize the importance of broad agreements between Washington and Jerusalem, focusing on defeating Hamas, enhancing security to prevent the kind of attack that happened on October 7th of last year. Regarding the Gaza Strip, Israel should reject Palestinian Authority administration because they're incapable of governing. And maybe Israel should promote civilian control by the business leaders in Gaza. Israel's military control of the entire Gaza Strip would probably benefit the residents of Gaza economically and civilly, while also distinguishing Gaza from the Palestinian Authority, thereby weakening the Palestinian national movement, which is devoted to the destruction of Israel. So what I tried to do in the last few minutes and give my overall understanding of what's happening. 30 years ago, Israel pulled out of Gaza, and now, 30 years later, we are fighting a war because of that mistake. Now, hopefully, the war will eventually end. All wars end, and the Palestinian, Hamas will be destroyed. The question is, what should come next? That would be good for Israel and for the Palestinians. For better or for worse, these millions of Palestinians are not going away. We're going to have to live with them. And we're going to have to figure out some way of governing them so that we can have some kind of peace. There's no doubt in my mind, by the way, that the entire education system of the Palestinian Authority will have to change, which means it'll take maybe 25 to 30 years just to produce a new generation of Palestinians who no longer are taught from childhood to hate Israel and to want to see Israel destroyed. There's no doubt that the present situation is an extremely sensitive one. We made big mistakes 30 years ago. We're living with the results of those mistakes, and we have to figure out how to be smarter to see to it that since all these Palestinians are not going away, we have to figure out how to live with them. That's a major problem, and we have to have wise enough leadership to know how to handle this. So what I tried to do in the last few minutes is describe the situation now as I see it. We're going to win this war in Gaza, hopefully with a minimal loss, but what happens next is going to be vital for the future of the state, and hopefully we'll have the proper people making decisions to see to it that our future is insured. So I just wanted to touch upon these things and share my thoughts with the listeners. We're in a very touchy situation. By the way, just to say a few more words about this, you know, it's interesting. The big country that's supporting the Palestinians right now is Iran. And Iran is a Shiite sect. There are two major Muslim groups in Islam. One is the Shiites, which is mainly in Iran, and the rest is the Sunni, which is most of the other Arab states. And it's interesting that the Shiites are the essentially Iran. And they're supporting the people in Gaza, even though they are Sunnis, because they'll support anybody who's against the state of Israel. So, and Hamas is an offshoot of the Islamic Brotherhood, and the Islamic Brotherhood, which began in Egypt a number of years ago, is devoted to the destruction of the state of Israel. So they're both Muslim groups, the Sunni and the Shiites, are hoping for the eventual rule of something they call the caliphate, but the caliphate can't be both the Sunni and the Shiite, and they've traditionally been in opposition to each other since the very beginning. That's why Egypt and many leaders of the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, are rooting for an Israeli defeat of Hamas. And it's a major reason why Saudi Arabia wishes for a formal defense agreement with the America against Iran. Saudi Arabia is Sunni. So what happened is that Israel came into existence in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel, and essentially in a section of the world that's dominated by Islam. And Islam is composed primarily of two groups, the Shiites and the Sunnis, who aren't that crazy about each other. So there's an alliance between the Palestinian and the Western Muslims, and unfortunately they're also making an alliance with the young people in the United States, Western Muslims, and because the progressive views are in the West are dominated by opposition to imperialism and capitalism, things like that. And that's why anti-Israel platforms have become almost centerpiece of all the things that are happening in the universities in the United States. Israel is looked upon as a colonizer, and anyone who colonizes is bad. So in a very complicated world, one in which a very large part of it is opposed to something we have to live with. I'll be back after the break.
Be smart. Listen to Israel News Talk Radio in the background while you work and get the latest news and commentary from Israel. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom, this is Nadia Matar from the Sovereignty Movement. At a time when there is so much disinformation, you have to know who to listen to know what really is going on in Israel. Israel News Talk Radio is the radio where you can know that what you hear is the truth.
Hello again. You're back with Jay Shapiro. Or maybe I should say I'm back with the listeners. Been away for several weeks. I was visiting in the United States, seeing members of my family who I haven't seen for a few years. At any rate, thank heaven I'm back here in Israel. And I've prepared a program which I hope is of interest to the listeners. First of all, it's important to note that next week is going to be the new lunar month. This lunar month, the lunar calendar that we, the Jews, use is going to bring us the holiday of Purim, which is a very joyous holiday. But it's also the Muslim month of Ramadan. And Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, and it culminates in a night of what's called Laylat al-Qadr, which occurs toward the end of the holy month. And it is a very important month in the Muslim calendar. And unfortunately, it appears that Hamas will continue to hold hostages in Gaza, and in a large extent, it'll hold the whole world hostage through its violence, extremism, and its systematic attempt to use people as human shields. It's all very unfortunate. It's essential that Hamas not be allowed to ruin Ramadan once again. It is a holy month for the Muslims. However, they turn a month of peace into a month of suffering. So that's what's coming up soon, so I have to keep our eye on it. So I just wanted to bring this up because there's a strong possibility that next week there'll be much more violence caused by the terrorist group because it is a holy month. Now, what I want to speak about now is the fact that I've been reading the papers in the United States and following up what's been happening there. Friends of mine saved a number of American newspapers from over the last months so that I could review them when I was there. And it turns out that anti-Semitism has reared its ugly head since October 7th. And the truth of the matter is, this anti-Semitism has been just below the surface for decades, and American leaders apparently are not aware of, were not aware of this, or chose not to be aware of this. The they should have seen how the students at various universities slowly over the years have become more open in their anti-Semitism, and a lot of the faculties have been taken over by anti-Semites. The students of notoriously anti-Israel Columbia University professor Edward Said have been pretty much taking over the Middle East Studies Department on campuses throughout the United States. They're funded, by the way, by money from Qatar, and together their followers have created a culture of anti-Semitism and anti-Americanism on the American campuses. This is true, for example, in the University of Pennsylvania, of which I am a graduate, and now the Jewish students find themselves in universities. They've been faced with physical violence and threats and intimidation, and this is continuing. There's no end in sight. An article was written by former Harvard professor Ruth Weiss, published in Commentary Magazine, revealed how the prestigious university's efforts to achieve what they call diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's known as DIV, and other decisions by the universities have entrenched anti-Semitism for about 20 or 30 years. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is essentially basically anti-Semitic, and Jews are suffering from it across campuses in the United States. As long as DEI is present on the university campuses, campus life will never be the way it was before 30 years ago. It's interesting, by the way, that there was a congressional interview or questioning of three college professors from Harvard, MIT, and Penn. Penn, as I said, I'm a graduate of Penn myself. Claudine Gray was deposed from her post as Harvard professor, and the professor of the University of Pennsylvania also quit, but they retained their very large professorships, getting like over $1 million a year. Meanwhile, the jobs of Jewish academics remain in jeopardy if they refrain from speaking out against Israel. Jewish organizations have made alliances over decades with many progressive and liberal causes, yet most of these alliances disappeared on October 7th, when many of the so-called progressive groups abandoned their Jewish colleagues and sided with their enemy. When the government of Qatar decided to trump Jewish alumni donors, and the government of Qatar is providing billions of dollars to universities and institutions, these felt free to exhibit their anti-Semitism. It's interesting. There are a large number of multi-million dollar Jewish donors to the universities, but they're being trumped by the money given by Qatar. And it's no wonder that the Qataris have not been called out enough for being the sponsor of Hamas and the funders of the massacre that occurred on October 7th, because the Qatar has essentially unlimited resources, and as I understand it, they've essentially purchased the faculties of major universities in the United States in the schools that are forming the next generation are now under the influence of Qatari money. Now, much has been known about the Qatari influence for at least 25 years, and nothing's been done about it. The top American universities have campuses in Qatar, by the way, and obtain unprecedented influence at almost every level of education in the United States. And the truth of the matter is that America must wake up and realize that Qatar is not part of the solution to any problem. However, Qatar is the cause of many challenging issues facing not just the Jews, but facing the United States itself. Israel has known that Qatar has been giving $320 million annually to Hamas and $800 million to the Palestinian Authority annually. That's a tremendous amount of money. Instead of revealing the extent of Qatar's brazenness to the world, the United States, as well as Israel, are making a big mistake but today using Qatari mediators to negotiate a ceasefire agreement in Gaza. Now, there is another Arab country, the United Arab Emirates, which normalized relations with Israel via something called the Abraham Accords, and it doesn't fund Hamas, and it would have been a much more sensible choice to be the go-between with Hamas. However, it seems now that if the United States and Israel don't change their course, it is likely that the influence of Qatar will grow. One of the Qatari state media is called Al Jazeera, very, very influential, continues poisoning Western minds if they're not banished from the United States and from Israel, as they should have been a long time ago. Truth of the matter is, as I see it, and again, I'm not an expert in these areas, but the United States should intensify its cooperation with the United Arab Emirates because, for example, they've changed their school curriculum there to eliminate anti-Semitism and encourage tolerance, as mandated by the Abraham Accords. Now, however, one of the things that's going to be required in when this war is over in Gaza, one is going to be the essential re-education of the people living in Gaza. It might take 30 years to inculcate a culture of peace instead of the anti-Semitism that's been taught over the last 30 years in Gaza. Since the agreement that was made with the terrorists that brought them back from North Africa almost 35 years ago, the educational system in Gaza has produced two or three generations of people who were taught anti-Semitism. So when this war is over in Gaza, Gaza's reconstruction should be conditioned on educational reconstruction, because if not, more wars will take place every few years. And what will happen is that Israel is going to have to keep fighting Gaza every few years. That is why the educational system there must be changed. And the Abraham Accords provide a platform for educational institutions and organizations to develop programs that promote cultural understanding and appreciation. By including curriculum on the history, the customs, the beliefs of neighboring nations, educators can help future generations to grow up with a more open and empathetic perspective on the diversity of this Middle Eastern region. The accords with the United Arab Emirates, for example, have gone a long way toward ending the scourge of anti-Semitism. It's because up until the agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, anti-Semitism and Jew hatred throughout the entire Arab world was taken for granted. And this has been shown to be able to be changed. So, to fight anti-Semitism in the Arab world, the key has to be the educational system. So, by the way, Israel should also act more assertively to show the international community that support by Qatar for extremist groups all around the world is a threat not only to Israel, but also to the United States and Europe. As long as Qatar is quietly with their zillions of dollars supporting anti-Western education, then the entire West is in danger from Qatar. It's commonly known for many years that Qatar has been nurturing extremist Islamic groups, promoting jihadist propaganda on its state-owned news network Al Jazeera, and fostering its ties with Iran. And Iran, of course, is the greatest threat to peace in the Middle East. Less well known is the detrimental influence Qatar has in Western societies, because Qatar has penetrated deep into American higher educational institutions, and its funding has gone hand in hand with the rise of anti-Semitic rhetoric in the elite universities in the United States. It turns out that even its investments in so-called humanitarian projects among Muslim communities in Europe are tainted with an agenda to promote a separatist Islamic identity. See, there's also evidence that Qatar's dubious involvement in the legislative processes of the European Parliament and several bribery scandals have been linked to it. It's interesting how a few years ago, nobody thought about Qatar. Qatar was way under the headlines. But over these years, for about 30 years, Qatar, which has an endless supply of money, has been influencing the universities and other institutions in Western Europe and in the United States. And today we are seeing the results of that. So the Western countries should understand what's happening, and they should send a message to Qatar that it cannot reap the benefits of partnership with the West while simultaneously supporting radical Islamism. The Qatar's mediation efforts, I think, could well be a phony. We don't really know what is driving the ambitions of Qatar. It is not pro-Western, that's for sure. Qatar has very quietly worked with zillions of dollars over the last few years. They've become very influential in the United States, in Europe. And it's something that's really, it's been under the headlines, and now it's become quite obvious. So the United States now should condition the upgrading of security cooperation with Qatar, for example, with arms deals. Qatar should really cut its ties with terrorist organization. A lot of the Hamas leaders, for example, live in Qatar. Qatar is supporting terrorism, and Qatar should be warned that its unwillingness to abandon its support for terror and increased pressure on Hamas could result in freezing Qatari assets, for example, in Western countries. They could limit its airlines' airspace and facilitate lawsuits by American terror victims against it. Right now, Qatar is a major supporter of terrorism. And the United States now considers Qatar an ally, but it should consider downgrading its status from an ally to a state sponsor of terrorism. I've learned all this in my recent visit to the States. I'll be back after the break.
Warning. Take cover. The Jewish Truth Bomb is here, the show that will explode all the false narratives and fake news. Join host Lenny Goldberg each week as he wires the news together and detonates it through biblical verses that will deliver a shockwave that will blow you away. Don't miss it. The Jewish Truth Bomb. Every Monday.
Hello again, you're back with Jay Shapiro. In this portion of the program, I want to start off with a historical item which is way, way under the shadows of history. I just heard about it myself several weeks ago, and I want to share what I learned with the listeners. It has to do with the area known as Newfoundland and Labrador, which is the easternmost province of Canada, which consists of the island of Newfoundland, with a population of a little more than 500,000, and Labrador, which is a very sparsely inhabited territory on the mainland of Canada. St. John's is the capital. The whole area has spectacular scenery, and however, Newfoundland has a dark history where Jews are concerned. It's something I never heard about before. I came across an article several weeks ago, and I want to share it with the listeners because it's really way under the shadow of history. Newfoundland is one of Britain's oldest overseas colonies, and it didn't become a part of Canada until 1949. It received self-government status as far back as 1854 and became an independent dominion of the British Empire in 1907, the same status as Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. In 1933, economic collapse led to the reestablishment of direct British rule by way of 6-member commission of government, 3 appointed from Britain and 3 from Newfoundland, and was presided over by a British appointed governor. By the middle of the 1930s, there were only a little more than 200 Jews in Newfoundland out of a total population of about 280,000. I mean, they're pretty much the same number of Jews today, about 200 Jews. However, Newfoundland attracted the attention of thousands of desperate Jews seeking a haven from anti-Semitism and persecution that ultimately resulted in the Holocaust. That's why I wanted to bring this subject up with the listeners. So the question is, why did so many Jews seek sanctuary in Newfoundland? A gentleman named Gerhard Bassler is a history professor at Memorial University, has written about this episode in history. He wrote a book, Sanctuary Denied, Refugees from the Third Reich and Newfoundland Immigration Policy. He wrote the book back in 1992, and he found that about 12,000 Jews sought entry into Newfoundland during the lead-up and early period of World War II. And many of these Jews, these refugees, were highly qualified professionals like doctors, as well as families that had means, and applicants who were immediate relatives of members of the existing Jewish community there. In addition to pleas for admission from individuals and families, proposals came from organizations such as Baron de Hirsch to settle groups of Jews in Newfoundland who were trying to escape from the Nazis. And the proposals were designed to help reduce the 25% unemployment rate and to spur agricultural and industrial development, or to provide qualified medical personnel to communities that needed them. Many of these Jews seeking refuge were doctors. A proposal organized by a member of the St. John's Jewish community offered to settle groups of Jewish refugees in Labrador in order to promote its industrial development. And another, a Seattle-based American entrepreneur, involved the settlement of Jewish refugees in Labrador to stimulate timber exports and develop a fish cannery industry. All three projects claimed to be self-funded ventures that would not be a financial burden to Newfoundland. In other words, Jews escaping from Hitler were trying to get into Newfoundland. That was the bottom line. All appeals, whether by individuals or by organizations, were unsuccessful. Only 12 Jewish refugees, 12, entered Newfoundland between 1933 and 1945. And these included a rabbi and his family and medical personnel hired because they're the only qualified individuals available, not because they were refugees. Not a single one of thousands of Jews appealing for rescue from persecution, including sponsored parents and brothers of naturalized Newfoundlanders, were saved. According to the record, the xenophobic attitude of the governing commission toward non-British immigrants was to blame. So why did so many Jews seek safety in Newfoundland? They can only point out to a generous clause in the Newfoundland Aliens Act of 1906, which offered asylum to refugees fleeing religious or political persecution. So does this mean that desperate Jews combed the constitutions and legislative literature of various jurisdictions to see which appeared to be more welcoming? Possibly. However, a more likely explanation has to do of the infamous Evian Conference of 1938. Now, let me remind the listeners what that was. In 1938, representatives of 32 countries met in the French town of Yon-le-Bain to find a solution to the Jewish refugee crisis precipitated by the anti-Semitism in Germany in 1933 and Austria in 1938. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were stateless. There were fears for the safety of millions more of Jews in Eastern Europe. The conference was an initiative by former President Franklin Roosevelt, was an abject failure. I've read books about it. With the exception of the Dominican Republic, which took in 700 Jewish refugees, no country, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, agreed to accept Jewish refugees. And Newfoundland itself didn't participate because of the loss of its independent status. On July 22, 1938, 1 week after the close of the conference, an editorial titled Happier Than Palestine appeared in the Ottawa Evening Citizen newspaper in Canada. The key points were that Jews would be happier in Newfoundland than in Palestine, particularly those from Poland who used to severe winters, and the people of Newfoundland needed help to develop their natural resources. And it concluded with a statement, an organized migration to to Newfoundland to include educated and cultured Jewish families up to the same high standard as the Jewish home builders in Palestine could make the oldest British colony indeed a Newfoundland of contentment and security. On July 26, 1938, the Jewish Telegraph Agency, which is a worldwide Jewish wire news service, and it's still an important important source of news today, reprinted the editorial that appeared in the Ottawa Citizen. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency must have caught the attention of Jews needing the place to go. The sanctuary was denied. That the terrible events that led to the Holocaust were incremental in nature. They didn't all happen at one time. They happened slowly. Each new step took place in response to the callous indifference of much of the world to the plight of the Jews. In this context, the refusal by the powers governing Newfoundland to grant help to any Jew seeking help had widespread and terrible repercussions. Now, I came across this article about Newfoundland and the Holocaust. And again, this country that could use people allowed 12 Jewish refugees from 1933 to 1945. This is something that's way under the headlines of history. I found this article, as I said a short while ago. I wanted to share it with the listeners. It's something that just is in the margins of history, and it really is an extreme example of how the world treated the Jews when they were really in difficulty. But Jews were never in the kind of difficulty that they were when Hitler came to power, and the world was indifferent. This is a historical fact, and I found this information about Newfoundland out. Wanted to share it with the listeners because this is another reason why we have to have a strong, independent state of Israel, because of what it means for the Jewish people now and for the future of the Jewish people. In our own lifetime, we've seen how the world could be indifferent to the plight of the Jews. And it's something we have to keep reminding ourselves about. Since we're talking about historical anti-Semitism, I want to say a few more words about what's happening right now. Santa Barbara, California, which, by the way, is a beautiful city. I used to go there on business. The University of California has a campus in Santa Barbara. It's north of Los Angeles. And Jewish students were harassed there. According to Santa Barbara Hillel, there were signs on the doors of the university saying Zionist not allowed. And the students, Jewish students, were confronted by mobs of their peers. Zionists not welcome was on dormitory rooms. Apparently in one of the dormitory rooms, one of the Jewish students had put up a mezuzah. And so it turns out that they marked the mezuzah with anti-Semitic signs. The students at the university are being harassed because they're Jewish. And that is what's happening on university campuses. And it's very, very unfortunate. And whether the university is really doing anything about it's really a question. But it's a problem on American campuses, and I want to. But the thing about the Jewish Santa Barbara students have facing anti-Semitism, very small item in the newspaper. I think it's important to note to the listeners that on the campuses today in the United States, anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism has become quite common. And since I'm talking about anti-Semitism in this segment of my program, I've found another thing. In England, Prince William said he was extremely concerned about soaring anti-Semitism in Britain. He said this during a visit to a London synagogue 2 weeks ago. He's the heir to the throne, Prince William, and a week after he called for an end to the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, saying too many people have been killed, William met the young ambassadors from the Holocaust Educational Trust who are seeking to tackle hatred that's happening against the British community. So what did the prince say? He said his wife and me are extremely concerned about the rise in anti-Semitism that you guys have talked about. I'm just so sorry if any of you have had to experience. That's why I'm here today to reassure you all that people do care and people do listen. So the prince, who's in line for the throne, he visited the Western Marble Arch Synagogue. He wore a kippah. He met Holocaust survivors and listened as Jewish students recounted how they had been what one describes as explosion in anti-Semitism, including death threats and assaults on Jewish students. Also, by another thing that's happening in Britain, again, these are the things that are under the headlines. The British Prime Minister, Sunak, announced £54 million of new funding to protect Jewish communities after figures showed anti-Semitic incidents had hit a record high in Britain last year. And that's what's happening in England. It's interesting. The Prince became the first senior British royal to make an official visit to Israel and the Palestinian territories back in 2018. So apparently he's following the region closely, and he wanted to speak out about the human suffering it had caused. That's according to his office. He withdrew from a memorial service at Windsor Castle for his godfather, the late King Constantine of Greece, and the prince is 41 years old, and he is now becoming very aware of anti-Semitism in Great Britain. So the anti-Semitism is on the rise all over the world, particularly in the United States and in Western Europe. Prince William is aware of it. He spoke about it. And as I said, the British Prime Minister has put another £54 million pounds toward protecting Jewish communities. These are difficult times for the Jews. I'll be back after the break.
You think you can get real news about Israel from major news sources located far away from Israel? Think again. Get it from the source. Israel News Talk Radio. Straight talk from Israel.
Hi, my name is Michael Ben-Noach from Slovakia. Israel News Talk Radio is just the best radio station in the world, and I listen every day.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. As a general rule, I don't spend that much time talking about the future of the Gaza Strip. Program is only on once a week, and I try as much as possible to present the listeners with information about things that are under the headlines and not the major subjects. But this week, I've decided that because the situation in the Gaza Strip after this war is over is of such importance that I've done a lot of reading about it. There are so many experts that it's embarrassing almost, particularly here in Israel, when you look at the Israeli news. The news commentators are generally surrounded at their while they're speaking with all kinds of experts who disagree about what's going to happen next. Nobody really knows what's going to happen next, but it is of importance because eventually, and hopefully sooner than later, the war in Gaza will end. And the question is, what will happen afterwards? So as I said, I've done a lot of reading about, and I want to share with the listeners, not so much what my opinion is, because I'm not really sure that I have an opinion, but I want to share with the listeners what all the so-called experts are saying. It's patently evident that the Gaza Strip cannot and will not, after the present armed conflict, return to being a Hamas headquarters, a terror hub. That's for sure. Similarly, it is no less evident that the Palestinian Authority, which is corrupt and failed and hopeless and incompetent, whether revitalized or renewed, could not ever be capable of administering Gaza anymore than it's been capable of administrating the West Bank areas. 30 years ago, Israel brought Arafat back from North Africa. He and his ilk have been unable to establish a viable state. And these are the facts on the ground. The problem is that this expression, the two-state solution, is being increasingly repeated day after day. Why? One can only wonder why serious international leaders, including the American president, the American Secretary of State, the UN Secretary General, and the European Union leadership, as all these international leaders can in good conscience continue to talk about a two-state solution as if it was some kind of magical solution, and if it's repeated often enough, it'll somehow move out of the sphere of wishful thinking and magically materialize into the sphere of reality. The word two-state solution has been bandied about for at least 70 years, and it's nowhere in sight. It's inconceivable to imagine that the leaders of the international community could be so irresponsible and essentially stupid to imagine that a peace-loving Palestinian political entity could materialize out of what there is now, out of the present Middle East realities. Either the people who are pushing for the two-state solution are ignorant of history, and they're definitely deceiving themselves, not only trying to deceive Israel, but a lot of people who talk about a two-state solution apparently believe that there is such an animal as a two-state solution. There is a lack of awareness of the background the history, the practical implications, and the feasibility of this thing called a two-state solution in the context of the history and reality of what it's like here in the Middle East, the dispute we're having with the Arabs. The idea of two states living side by side peacefully has figured in international documentation for years already. It started with what's known as the Clinton parameters back in 2000. There was a roadmap to a permanent two-state solution in 2003, and it was even repeated in a letter by President George W. Bush to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon back in 2004. And it even goes back to the UN resolution of 1949, saying there'd be an Arab state and a Jewish state. This is the beginning of the two-state solution. However, it's never been agreed to by the parties themselves, particularly by the Palestinians. On the contrary, as agreed to in the Oslo Accords, the permanent status of the territories remains an open negotiating issue. The Accords made absolutely no mention of anything called a Palestinian state. So, the repetition for a two-state solution sort of prejudges the potential future outcome of any kind of permanent status agreement between Israel and a reliable, legitimate Palestinian authority. Now, clearly, a two-state solution cannot be imposed on unwilling parties. A two-state solution can only come from a negotiated settlement between Israel and another party, like a unified, fully representative, responsible, and capable Palestinian leadership, and which does not exist today. We can't deal with a conglomerate of terror groups. You can't make any kind of settlement then. Nor could it be the result of any off-the-cuff political declaration or resolution imposed by the UN or the EU or any other source, or from vague calls from naive international leaders for a two-state solution as a form of political correctness or collective wishful thinking. The word two-state solution has been bandied about since 1949, and it's just proven not to be meaningful. It has no meaning whatsoever. A politically and economically unstable and non-viable Palestinian entity would represent an invitation for more meddling by foreign countries like Iran, an intrusion. Because this is the kind of thing that's occurring today in Syria, in Lebanon, and Yemen. The Iranians are mixing in those countries. And if somebody comes up with a two-state solution, no doubt the Iranians would mix it in that too. This would constitute a constant and greater threat both to Israel's security as well as to regional and international stability. By the same token, a viable, credible, and logical solution would not necessarily require Palestinian statehood, which remains a dangerous, unreliable, unforeseeable, and impractical alternative. Why? Because in light of the Palestinian incapability of developing any unified and accepted leadership, they were brought back from North Africa 30 years ago, have been incapable, or just maybe they're undesirable, of developing a unified and acceptive leadership. They have a total anarchy, which is taken over by Hamas. That's what's happened under the Palestinian Authority. Now, you hear new options being mentioned. They use words like autonomy, federation, confederation, condominium. They even use a word called co-imperium. Neither the Israelis nor the Palestinians, nor even the international, those who agreed to the Oslo Accords like the United States, the European Union, Russia, Egypt, Jordan, and even Norway, who agreed to the Oslo Accords, none of them committed themselves in any of these accords to establish a Palestinian state. The word Palestinian state does not appear in any of the accords that were agreed to 30 years ago. In any event, based on experience from previous agreements between Israel and the Palestinians, any viable, realistic, and long-term solution, whatever it may be, will have to be accompanied by solid, credible, and reliable international guarantees. In other words, the international community would have to provide legal, political, and security agreements to any kind of final agreement with the Palestinians. And any kind of agreement that will have guarantees that have to ensure that an agreed solution will not be abused, undermined, violated, or abrogated by such dangerous regional elements as Islam or any future Palestinian entity or regional grouping. In other words, it's all wishful thinking, because any guarantees would have to assure Israel's sovereignty and the security of the Israeli population. And there is nothing on the horizon that could bring about such a guarantee. And regrettably, it is highly unlikely that any potential United Nations framework, whether temporary or permanent, would ensure anything, any kind of guarantee of regional stability. The total incompetence and uselessness of the United Nations, as indicated by its regrettable history, are testimony to the fact that the UN cannot be relied on whatsoever. As a matter of fact, as an example, this is borne out by the fact that rather than dealing with the welfare of Gaza, the people in Gaza, the UNRWA has become a vehicle for prolongation of refugee victimhood, as well as a front organization for assisting and fueling Hamas terror. The UNRWA, UN Relief and Works Administration, simply has become a tool in the Hamas terror. Also, there's been an abject failure of UNIFIL to prevent the presence of Hezbollah in proximity to the border between Lebanon and Israel. There was a UN Security Council resolution back in 2006 that said UNIFIL would prevent the presence of Hezbollah, and they've done nothing. So we have Hamas in Gaza, we have Hezbollah in Lebanon. The UN was supposed to take care of all these things. It's done nothing. And if anything, it supported these terrorist organizations. So what we have is the United Nations incompetence, duplicity. Rather than assisting and encouraging peace in the area, it's proven to be central contributing factors to the present conflict. In other words, the UN is a major contributor to the conflict with which Israel finds itself in. So the truth of the matter is that if the international leaders really wanted to find a viable solution to the conflict as a means of restoring, maintaining, and guaranteeing regional peace and security, they cannot continue to deceive themselves with the delusion of a two-state solution. The world has to face a reality and to pull their heads out of the sand. The question is whether the UN or any international organization is capable of doing so, or whether they generally want to do so, or are they going to simply keep repeating the two-state solution as if it was something real? It is not something real at the moment. By the way, on top of all this, there's something else happening this year, very sensitive. The Biden administration wants to get reelected, and there are certain states where there's a very large Arab vote. And Israel is expecting continued American assistance. And right now, Israel has to deal with a quite transparent American diplomatic and financial moves to promote a Palestinian state. Because the administration now, the American administration, is sending its various agents that speak. They have been speaking to the Muslim American leaders in places like Dearborn, Michigan, and they're saying things that are very positive toward the creation of a Palestinian state. So on one hand, we know that a Palestinian state is simply not viable. It will not happen. On the other hand, we have an election year in which the American administration is probably talking about a Palestinian state. For example, a guy named John Feiner, who's the Deputy National Security Advisor of President Biden, spoke privately to a Muslim American leaders in Dearborn, Michigan, and said, "We're very well aware that we have missteps in the course of responding to the crisis since October 7th, and I do not have any confidence in this current government of Israel." Unquote. This is a representative of the American president, his name John Feiner, speaking to a Muslim group in Michigan, because this is an election year. And according to White House Press Secretary Jean-Pierre, the administration may be imposing new standards for military aid to Israel. So Israel, it appears, is expecting continued American assistance, need to deal with a quite transparent new American diplomatic and financial move to promote a Palestinian state. These are the facts on the ground. So in a sense, I have to apologize to the listeners for spending so much time. I generally like to give a picture of what's happening in Israel under the headlines. But I was out of the country. I was in the States for 2 weeks. I came back. I look at the headlines. I listen to television. And I see there's an awful lot of talk again about a two-state solution. Something that has been nipped in the bud, really. So until next time, thanks for listening. Jay Shapiro, signing off.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.